prevention and combating of hate crimes, hate speech bill. Let me also welcome the parliamentary legal team, as well as the legal team from the Department of Justice who are on the platform. And I take it that also some of the stakeholders on the platform, welcome to yourself as well. Well, members, just in terms of today's proceedings, we expect a presentation from the United Ulama Council of South Africa, KUSATU, the Gender Diversity Coalition, the Cause for Justice, Media Monitoring Africa, the Association of Christian Media, and Lita Labantu. I should just indicate to members that the Cause for Justice presentation will not be made. We received an apology from Mr. Ryan Smith, but be that as it may, we'll adjust the program as we move along. That being said, honorable members, the first presenter is, I don't have a name, Mr. Mohammed, I think. Yeah, Mr. I. Mohammed, I don't know if he is present. Gershwin, please assist me.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Let me take this moment to welcome you to the meeting of the Select Committee. We've received your presentation on the hate crime, hate speech bill, your written submission, and we thank you for wanting to make an oral submission to the committee as well. We would give you 15 minutes to do that. Thereafter, as the committee members will then ask you questions for clarity. And we request that if you could please focus on what your issues are with the bill and what your recommendations are. Over to yourself, Mr. Mohammed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good afternoon, honorable members and all other participants. And since we are discussing hate crimes, allow me to greet you with a universal greeting of peace. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. This law will create two crimes, the offense of hate crime and the offense of hate speech. The bill describes a hate crime as defined as an offense recognized under any law committed by a person who is motivated by their prejudice or intolerance towards victims. The words prejudice and intolerance are not defined by the act. We don't know whether from this time when this act is enacted, whether from that moment onwards, nobody will be allowed to hold any prejudices or intolerances. We don't know whether people will be allowed to hold prejudices or intolerances, but only to a certain extent. And we don't know where that line will be drawn. The bill doesn't help us. The offense of hate speech is committed when a person communicates in a manner that shows a clear intention to be harmful, to incite harm, or to promote or propagate hatred. The words harmful, harm, and hatred are not defined, clearly defined. The word harm is defined in Section 1. However, the definition doesn't tell us much. It doesn't tell us the precise conduct on the part of the accused which will constitute harm. It does not tell us what effect on the victim will constitute harm. Allow me to demonstrate by way of an example. Murder is defined as the unlawful and intentional killing of another person. In this example, we can see that the accused person's conduct is clearly described, as well as the effect on the victim. Attempted murder is more or less the same, except that the effect on the victim is different. Here, the victim survives. Again, the conduct of the accused and the effect on the victim is clearly described. The bill defines harm as substantial emotional, psychological, physical, social, or economic detriment that objectively and severely undermines the human dignity of the victim. Here, again, we have a phrase that does not put meat on the words of the constitutional imperatives. The practical implementation of the law requires precision in the meanings of these pivotal words. Otherwise, it results in vagueness. Regarding this vagueness, the Constitutional Court said that a norm, a rule, cannot be regarded as a law unless it is formulated with sufficient precision to enable the citizen to regulate his conduct. He must be able to foresee the consequences which a given action may entail. The same court said in another case that it is an important principle of the rule of law that the rules be stated in a clear and accessible manner. One of the more important cases in hate speech coming from the Constitutional Court is the Quilani case. And I will just give a summary of how the Constitutional Court defined hate speech. So, we understand from the Constitutional Court, firstly, it says what hate speech is not. So therefore, hate speech is not offensive expression. Hate speech is not discrediting statements, humiliating statements, hurtful statements, offensive statements. Hate speech cannot stifle ideology, belief, or views. It cannot silence disturbing or shocking views. Hate speech cannot violate the rights of others. Then the court goes on to say, what is hate speech? Hate speech is extreme detestation and vilification. It risks discriminatory activities. I will come back to that discriminatory activities. I looked at the Canadian court's definition, and it is very similar to the Quilani court's definition. The United Nations says that any kind of communication that uses pejorative or discriminatory language will amount to hate speech. But it acknowledges that there is no accepted definition for hate speech globally. So let me go to the Quilani case again. The Constitutional Court says that hate speech is the detestation or vilification, that the detestation and vilification must amount to making the victim out to be less than human. And therefore, the victim does not qualify for the protection of human rights or the law before the communication can be regarded as hate speech. So to sum this up, the bill is required to translate the constitutional imperatives into practical law. We submit that it does not do that. In fact, it confuses even further. Another section of the bill which is vague and unclear is section 4D. 4D is the religious exclusion. I will deal with the section as it relates to Muslims. This section says that the provisions of subsection 4.1 do not apply in respect of anything done as contemplated in subsection 4.1 if it is done in good faith in the course of engagement in the bona fide interpretation and proselytizing or espousing of any religious tenet. Simply put, conduct will not amount to hate speech if it is done in good faith, if it is a good faith interpretation of any religious tenet, and conduct will not amount to hate speech if it does not advocate hatred that constitutes incitement to cause harm. I will only look at the bona fide one. This phrase is a Latin equivalent of good faith. This phrase implies that the state apparatuses, the police and the NPA, as well as the courts and other tribunals, will be tasked with deciding what qualifies as a bona fide interpretation of any religious tenet, belief, teaching, doctrine, or writing. This will be unlawful in that it will violate Section 15 of the Constitution, as well as the doctrine of religious non-entanglement. As traversed above, everyone has the freedom of religion. In constitutional terms, this means that everyone has the freedom to choose what to believe in and what not to believe in. In this regard, the Constitutional Court said, as a general matter, the court should not be concerned with questions whether, as a matter of religious doctrine, a particular practice is central to the religion. So, put that differently, the court should not be concerned with questions whether, as a matter of religious doctrine, a particular practice is a bona fide interpretation of the religion. This is what the Constitutional Court said. And yet this bill says differently. Religion is a matter of faith, because the court continues. The beliefs that believers hold sacred is thus central to their religious faith. May strike non-believers as bizarre, illogical, or irrational. Human beings may freely believe in what they cannot prove. Let me go on to the next section. Regarding the doctrine of non-entanglement, the Supreme Court of Appeal said, a court should refrain from determining the doctrinal issues in order to avoid entanglement. It would thus seem that a proper respect for freedom of religion precludes a court from pronouncing on matters of religious doctrine, which fall within the exclusive realm of the Church. For these reasons, subsection 4.2d, to the extent that it speaks of the good faith and bona fide interpretation, will be unlawful. I want to just speak about another part that comes from the Fourie Court. The Fourie Court is the court that ordered government to legalize homosexual marriage. This court says, these provisions taken together affirm the right of people to self-expression without being forced to subordinate themselves to the cultural and religious norms of others, and highlight the importance of individuals and communities being able to enjoy what has been called the right to be different. The Fourie Court continued and said that in each case that was decided on these constitutional provisions, space has been found for members of communities to depart from a majoritarian norm, and that these provisions collectively and separately acknowledge the rich tapestry constituted by civil society, indicating in particular that language, culture, and religion constitute a strong weave in the overall pattern. The lessons that we learn from the wisdom of our highest court is that South Africa is constituted from a multitude of different colored strands. When they are woven together, they strengthen each other, and all together they make for a formidable nation. However, when this heterogeneity is sacrificed at the altar of a contrived sameness, then the real sacrifice is the very soul of our nation. Every instance in which we dictate to religious persons that they must practice less of their religion, or that they must practice their religion differently in a manner that we decide, that is when we eviscerate the soul from the person. Then, in our overzealous activism to manufacture an egalitarian society, we remove the color from our rainbow. Instead of building a people where everyone respects each other's dignity, our efforts get us nothing except a nation of Frankensteins, a country full of people who are unable to recognize themselves. Instead of having respect for each other because one built up the other, we hate each other because in order to give to the one, we take from the other. Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Chair.
Thank you very much, Mr. Mohammed, for your presentation on behalf of your organization. Our members, do you have any questions for clarity that you would want to pose? Honorable Smith, I'll start with you.
Thank you, Chairperson. My first question would be in terms of the different wordings that the presenter said is not defined within the bill. I would like to hear in presenter what those definitions will look like if he can present us with the different presentations on all the different words that need to be defined. Thank you.
You broke a bit, but I understand that you want him to deal with the definitions of the words he says were not defined in the book. All right.
Can you just bear with me for a bit?
I'm just taking questions from all the members and then you can respond after that. Is that okay?
That is good.
Okay. Honorable Dadoo?
I was saying that Honorable Smith has covered me, specifically the ways that I want the presenter to define in his own way, because he say they are not sufficiently defined or explicitly defined. Among them is harm, the other one is hate, and I think the other one is victim. Thank you, Chair.
He can
also comment on the issue of the maximum sentence. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much, Honorable Dadoo. Honorable Mikulaki, I hope I captured the Honorable Smith's question as well correctly. He did break out a bit. Honorable Mikulaki.
Thank you very much, Chair. Good afternoon, everyone. Good afternoon, Mr. Mohammed. Just with regard to Clause 4.2 of the bill, you spent some time speaking about the exclusion of religious freedom as an act of good faith. The department might say they included, specifically that clause to ensure that they protect the right of freedom of religion. In what way would you say that that clause as it currently stands is not sufficient to protect your freedom of religion, specifically with regards to the fact that it then, as they would argue, only excludes statements made outside of the place of worship and those made in bad faith. In what way would you say the current clause as it is, based on that, is not sufficient? That would be my first question. Then my second question is, your issue with the bill, is it only with the hate speech part of the bill, or is it also with the hate crimes part, in other words, the whole of the bill? We had a discussion yesterday on from various of the stakeholders where they said that the hate speech part of the bill is necessary. The hate crimes part is necessary. The hate speech part is already covered by other legislation sufficiently. Would you agree with that, or would you say that it's the whole of the bill that is an issue, and why? Also, I didn't hear your opinion, if you have one, on the 8 years maximum sentence for a first offence that they mentioned. So I would like to hear your thoughts if you have any specific comments on that. And the final question that I have for you is, if the bill is then, in your opinion, undesirable in its totality or in part, how would you suggest that, because some of the of the concerns that were raised from those who feel that the bill is very urgently needed are very valid concerns. It's a fear of being victimized for who they are. How would you propose that we as a society then deal with the issues that specifically, say for example, the LGBTQI plus community faces in terms of hate crimes and hate speech? If the bill in its totality is undesirable, how should we as a society then ensure that we protect their freedoms as we protect the freedom of religion as well? Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Galatis. Over to yourself, Mr. Mohamed, to respond.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you to the members and for the questions. the issue of the definition, the first question, I must admit that this question is not easily answered. And the Constitutional Court admits this. And the United Nations on this matter also admits the same, that this question of defining what is hate speech is not easily answered. But in my presentation and in our written submissions, we say that the Constitutional Court in the Kwelane case says that you exceed the line of free speech when your speech makes the victim out to be less than human. It makes the victim out to be not entitled to the protection of human rights or the protection of law. That is essentially what I read in the Kwelane case. Now, the reason why there is another manifestation of how difficult it is to define what hate speech is, and that is because over the last 10 years, we've seen a number of cases come before the court, and which some might say that the judgments were strange. And the reason why the judgments were strange is because the courts gave conflicting judgments on hate speech. And in the Kwelane case particularly, the court spends a lot of time on the definition of hate speech. And then right at the end, it just simply says, well, the man is guilty, Mr. Kwelane is guilty of hate speech because of one or two reasons. But it doesn't actually apply the definition that it created itself, that court. And that definition, I say, is the definition that says hate speech crosses the line, or rather free speech crosses the line into hate speech when it makes the victim out to be less than human and not worthy of protection. Regarding the minimum sentencing, I do find that the minimum sentencing is quite heavy. And the reason for that is it is similar to the minimum sentencing for murder and attempted murder. Murder, or I don't practice criminal law, so I'm not so good with sentences.
It's a maximum sentence of 8 years.
It is,
A maximum sentence of 8 years.
Of 8 years, yes. So it is similar to the minimum sentence for attempted murder or the minimum sentence for murder. So I don't know, but it appears that we regard hate speech as so abominable that we will equate it to that kind of crime. And I think, given our past, we should rather take a educational role in our sentencing instead of a punitive role in our sentencing. Because our communities still have to learn how not to hate each other. And we are not going to teach our communities how not to hate each other by creating more hate. by, for instance, if an imam gets onto a pulpit and says that in Islam, homosexual conduct is a sin, and such imam have to face court and be sentenced, something like that will create more hatred between our communities instead of bringing us closer together. It will create more of a bully type of conduct by government instead of conciliatory type of conduct by government. Regarding the question of the hate crimes and the hate speech, you will notice in our written comments, we didn't deal with hate crimes because essentially we don't have a problem with the hate crimes section, except for there are two words in the hate crimes section which are not sufficiently defined. And those words are pivotal in what constitutes a hate crime. Those words are prejudice and intolerance. We don't know what will constitute prejudice or intolerance. Or is a simple intolerance, will that amount to a hate crime or not? Those two words are central in the determination of a hate crime. Otherwise, we essentially don't have a problem with that section of the bill. And coming back to the question of section 42D, that for us is a huge problem, an absolutely huge problem. And the reason for that is that section 41 says that a person will be guilty of a hate crime if he does certain conduct. And then the exclusion under section 4 says that the person will not be guilty of the crimes mentioned in section 4.1 if he does what he does for artistic creativity, performance, or expression. The B is academic or scientific inquiry. And C says for reporting in the public interest and certain other things. So those are the first three, A, B, and C. But then the exclusion treats religion differently from the first three. The first three are absolute. Those are absolute exclusions. But the religion has a different type of exclusion. Religion says the 4.1 will not apply if the conduct is done in good faith, in the course of engagement in bona fide interpretation and proselytizing or espousing of any religious conviction, tenet, belief, teaching, doctrine, or writings. So the questioner has rightfully said that I spent a lot of time on this. And the reason for that is because who will decide what is a bona fide interpretation of a religious tenet? And the Constitutional Court has already said nobody has the right to decide that except the person himself. Who the person himself has the right to decide what he believes in and what he does not believe in. The Constitutional Court has also decided that the courts cannot get involved in what constitutes a religious belief or a religious tenet. And here this bill says that the court has the right to decide, or a policeman has the right to decide, or the NPA has the right to decide what is a bona fide interpretation of a religious tenet, or religious belief, or religious teaching, religious doctrine, or religious writings. So the questioner also mentioned the issue of the LGBTQ, and it is well known that many religions believe that homosexual conduct, but let me speak for Muslims, Islam regards homosexual conduct as a sin. So does that mean that from now onwards, Muslims cannot now say so. And I will draw your attention. In June 2022, the Muslim Judicial Council, based in Cape Town, issued a religious edict in which they explained Islam's stance towards the homosexual conduct. And a number of articles from NGOs and highly placed academics around the country was placed in newspapers castigating the Muslim Judicial Council and Islam in general. And in fact, one NGO, a very highly regarded NGO in Cape Town, basically said that Islam is based on archaic law and archaic documents and they should modernize. This is the type of conduct that Muslims have to deal with. So I don't know which one of the two is that will be regarded as hate speech. Muslims saying that hate speech or LGBTQ conduct is a sin in Islam, or the NGO telling Muslims that what you believe in is archaic and you should modernize. This is what we had to endure last year, from simply saying what we believe in. But this bill says that the police and the NPA and the courts will have the right to decide what is a bona fide interpretation of the religion. And this is not allowed by the law. So I cannot understand how it can be in the bill. That is the first one is, why is the religion exclusion, the religious exclusion, treated differently from the first three exclusions? The other three exclusions are absolute, except the religious exclusion. And then, right at the end, the religious exclusion says that subsection 4.1 will not apply in respect of anything done if it is a religious, if it is done in good faith as a religious tenant, but it still cannot advocate hatred or cause harm. So I don't understand what the exclusion is, because the exclusion excludes a statement that says that it's an exclusion from 4.1, but then it still says as long as it's not what 4.1 says it should be. So for me, that is a circular argument. It contradicts itself. It's an exclusion and then it excludes from the exclusion. The last words of the sentence excludes the exclusion from the exclusion. And that doesn't make sense. So those are my responses. I don't know whether I clarified it, Ms. Chair.
Yes, no, thank you very much, Mr. Mohammed. For those responses, they're sufficient. They are your responses. Let me once again thank you for responding to members' questions and for coming to make your presentation to the committee. Our session with you is over for now.
Thank you very much, and thank you to everyone.
Honourable members, we'll then move on to the next presenter, which is from COSATU. The presenter is Mr. Matthew Park. I don't know if he is on the platform, Mr. Park. Oh, you are. Welcome, Mr. Park, to the session with the Select Committee. Let me thank you and your organization for making your input into this bill, as well as agreeing to come and make a presentation to the committee. We'll be giving you 15 minutes to make that presentation, and thereafter members will engage you if they have questions for clarity. We would prefer that you actually hone in on what your issues are with the bill and what your recommendations would be. Over to you, Mr. Parks.
Good afternoon, Chair members. Thank you for giving us space as I started just to share our views on the bill. We do appreciate it. So we just upload presentation, and I'm sure, Chair, we can even do less than 50 minutes. So, Chair, look, I mean, obviously, at COSATU, we are part of society. Our members experience hate crimes. They experience, like every other South African, the most brutal hate crimes before 1994 under apartheid. And, you know, workers say you would see reports in media instances from time to time because maybe they're vulnerable, they're poor, they're women, and so forth. Real victims of horrific race crimes. We've seen, you know, cleaners at the University of Free State being urinated on. We've seen workers, domestic workers, being physically assaulted. Many other instances. So this is what guides our support for this bill. We think CHEZ is really long overdue, more so given our history, and that we shouldn't take our history lightly. We think the bill, you know, it will not be a magic wand, but I think it'll be a critical tool in combating hate crimes and hate speech, and even preventing it, because it's going to send us a clear message to society that we won't tolerate certain levels of behavior. And some people will have to pay a consequence for that. Of course, the bill in itself, like any other law, will never be enough. There has to be additional actions, but legislation is helpful, Chair, because it helps to change society's culture, definition of what's acceptable, what's not acceptable. You won't get complete adherence to, and hence the police play a role, but it's necessary. Obviously, because our race is intertwined with the socioeconomic issues, poverty, inequality, unemployment is often linked to the color of your skin or your gender and so forth. So there is a need for additional socioeconomic interventions by government, by business, etc., to help to tackle the legacy of discrimination. And whilst we support this progressive bill, we believe there is a need for one further, just to further strengthen it, specifically with regard to its provisions dealing with the definition of harm, what constitutes harm. So, Chair, I think, you know, as you said, we support the objectives of the bill, because we believe it's a progressive bill. It's going to help strengthen the capacity of the states to prosecute hate crimes and hate speech, which are a reality. We think it's going to also help ensure the legislation dealing with hate crimes and hate speech are in line with the Constitution. And the Constitution is quite clear that all citizens are protected from unfair discrimination. And again, this should not be a shocking matter. Our history of colonialism, of apartheid, are very well known. And the fundamental ethos for those systems of governance was, besides economic exploitation, was about hate crimes, hate speech, brutal discrimination. And we still are witnessing those scars to many degrees. You know, if you look around Cape Town, for example, you can still see the legacies of apartheid special planning in a very stark form. I think also, maybe to take a step back, you know, the history of hate crimes and the consequences of hate speech internationally are well known. At times we might take it lightly. Are we interfering with freedom of speech? We don't think so. And we just simply need to refer to the example of what happened in Rwanda in 1994, how the radio stations were used to mobilize people to commit genocide against Tutsi, the Tutsi minority. We can look at the civil war in the former Yugoslavia in the 90s, where Muslims were persecuted, Bosnians. Entire societies were mobilized against each other on an ethnic basis. And of course, you know, the Holocaust in World War II, where Jews, Gypsies, or Roma, rather, homosexuals, etc., were literally targeted for genocide, that millions of who lost lives. So we became a democratic state in 1994. We adopted correctly a very progressive constitution, and it specifically says we prohibit unfair discrimination. But we have still seen, Chair, many cases in South Africa of hate speech and hate crimes. At times we take it lightly, but we should be looking at what are the consequences for the victim of these instances, and we should be erring on the side of those victims. We believe that, you know, at times some of these instances have just merely infringed upon an individual's right to dignity. Others, they have been accompanied by violence. So there's another thing we can take lightly. And I think we all got a bit of a wake-up call in July 2021 when we had the violence, mass violence taking place at Gauteng, KwaZulu-Natal. And leave aside the political and the criminal orchestration and the opportunist elements behind it, but there was elements of hate speech too. But it just shows you how combustible society is. A small incident can explode and lead to very serious loss of life, property, and so forth, damage to the country. Chair, now we will obviously refer to the constitutional right of freedom of speech and political beliefs. We always have to make sure we get the right balance between protecting the rights of individuals from harm and, of course, recognizing we are a constitutional democracy, we have political freedoms, freedom of speech, and so forth. We think the bill does achieve the correct balance between prohibiting hate speech on the one hand and simultaneously recognizing and not infringing unfairly upon the constitutional rights to freedom of speech and political belief. And of course, all rights come with responsibilities as well, and limitations at times. We do think that the previous, you know, the bill went through some positive enhancements, cleaning up in the portfolio committee processes. So, for example, they removed the issue of political affiliation or conviction, as well as occupational trade from cover, from hate speech, because I think partly providing the balance of freedom of speech. Because we know, Chair, that, you know, political parties during elections, other political engagements, would often criticize each other, often very robustly. So you don't want to interfere in that, but I think the revisions of the bill help to avoid that. Trade unions too, Chair, are very noisy institutions, very robust. And at times, during the process of collective bargaining, of recruitment, of other campaigns, trade unions will insult or criticize owners and managers of the companies. And this is part of the constitutional democracy, but doesn't constitute hate speech. So we think it is correct to kind of ensure the bill didn't conflict with those issues, because you want to kind of provide a bright balance between the rights of individuals from protection from hate crimes, and also recognizing the right to political expression, freedom of speech, etc. So, Chair, the one area we had thought might need some tightening up. So we support the definition of harm in the bill. It's currently referred to as harm means any emotional, psychological, physical, social, economic harm. And those are fine definitions. But we think, Chair, there's a mistake in the bill where we should have also made reference to cultural harm. The bill does recognize hate speech and hate crimes that impact upon culture. But this isn't carried through as we think it should logically have been done so to the recognition of harm in terms of culture. So to give examples why. So we believe that the harm personal community can suffer, do suffer often, from hate speech and hate crimes can materialize culturally as well. We will recall an incident in Cape Town a few years ago on a beach, I think Camps Bay, where, you know, people were insulting African culture for wanting to sacrifice cattle there and so forth. It showed that metaphor violates some bylaws, but I think it highlighted the point that at times people can go a bit too far when they criticize each other, more especially when they criticize cultural practices. We also saw, Chair, shamefully to all of us, a similar prevention of Muslim communities carrying out religious or cultural practices. So a few years ago, we saw that the call to prayer by the mosque became a rallying point for residents of Centurion who mobilized against it. And said that obviously causes significant psychological, cultural harm to those individuals, to those communities. And we've seen a very strong linkage between hate speech and mobilization against cultural practices. And this has a significant impact upon those communities. Yes, you could say it harms psychologically, socially, and so forth. But also there is a cultural impact too, which a Muslim community in Centurion is not able to go to pray in peace. That's a cultural harm to that community. Similarly, African communities can't exercise their cultural traditions. Equally, that would also qualify. So our proposal, Chair, is simply to insert the word cultural in the definitions of harm. So just insert it after social and before economic harm in the definition of harm in clause one of the bill. We think that will then help to ensure the bill provides a full scope of coverage and intent and so forth. And I think also make a message to society as well, that people should respect each other's culture, religious traditions and needs and so forth. So in conclusion, Chair, what it says, Kusawati, we do support this bill. We support its speedy passage by Parliament. We look forward to being enacted into law before the end of this administration. It's been a long journey for it to get to reach this stage. We think it's going to play a positive role in empowering the state to tackle such crimes and also to protecting all citizens' rights, especially the most vulnerable. We think it's in line with and gives expression to the objectives of the Constitution and the Bill of Rights, which is preventing unfair discrimination. We think it does provide a fair balance of the rights of citizens in terms of freedom of expression, freedom of speech, political views, etc. And these always have to be balanced with other people's rights as well. We think, as we just said, Chair, the bill does need to be strengthened simply to recognize the harm hate speech and hate crimes can do to citizens' cultural rights. So, Chair, lastly, we look forward to this bill's passage. And, of course, it will mean the significant amount of work by the Department of Justice to empower the courts, by the police service, to train police officers, also by our schools, the universities, to educate children, students, learners, the public broadcaster, SABC, because we can have very good laws, but we need to make sure society understands them, is aware of their rights and responsibilities, because government can do so much. We all have a responsibility to assist government to implementing these laws and really make South Africa share the freedom of charter says, a country which belongs to all who lived in it, black and white. So thanks very much, Chair, and hope I stuck to the time. Thank you, Chair members.
Thank you very much, Mr. Matthew Park, for your presentation on behalf of Kusani. Honourable members, do you have any questions for clarity? Honourable Zadovu? Okay, Honourable Zadovu.
Thank you very much, Honourable Chair. Let me take this opportunity to thank the presenter for his presentation. Just a few questions from my side. The first one, do I understand the presenter to say if he says that the definition of harm must be expanded to incorporate the cultural harm? Is that the firm proposal that he's putting on the table, or is there any other expansion that he would want to elaborate on in respect of his proposal? That is one. Two, there are some critics who say this bill as it stands will not pass the constitutional muster precisely because it encroaches on the Section 38 clause of the Constitution, which deals with the limitation of rights. What is the view of COSATU in respect of that? The third one, Honourable Chair, relates to justice. There are forms of justice that other people are proposing. One is retributive justice, of course. This is the one you're talking about, that those who perpetuate hate crime or hate speech must be punished, and they are offending other citizens of the country. But the other justice that people talk about is restorative justice, where in which the perpetrator and the victim can be sat down, engaged, and so on and so forth. What is the view of COSATU in relation to that, but also on the fact that the privileged people in this country must support this initiative in order to ensure that there is redistribution of wealth and resources to the people? What is the view of COSATU in terms of that? And lastly, Honorable Chair, what is the view of COSATU in respect of the maximum sentence of 8 years? Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Honourable Zadovu. Honourable Badenhorst.
Okay, thank you very much, and good afternoon. Thank you, Mr. Parks, for your input into this bill. Much appreciated. I've just got one question, if I may. You concentrated quite a bit on the element of harm, and you've made a suggested insertion into that specific element. There is however another element to this bill which is quite important, and that's the element of hate. Many of the previous presenters that we've had over the past 2 days have brought it to our attention that the bill wishes to criminalize hate speech, but it fails to actually define hate or hatred. So that becomes problematic in the sense that if Parliament is then the legislator and needs to pass the bill, it would then abdicate its responsibility to the courts to decide what hate would then be, or what the hateful action would be. It also then makes this bill very unclear to members of the public, who would then not know when they are breaking it in the absence of a clear definition of hatred. So I'd just like to get your opinion on that absence of a definition of hatred. Thank you very much, sir.
Thank you very much, Honourable Badenhorst. Honourable Smith?
Thank you, Chairperson. Honourable Chair, My question to Mr. Parks is, in terms of the insertion that he suggests on cultural harm, how would he say, you know, it'd be balanced between, you know, different culture, because what is will be harmful towards one culture might not be harmful to another, and that, you know, what one culture maybe believes in, for example, the slaughtering of animals on the beach, as he mentioned, will, you know, will be harmful to another culture, emotionally so and so forth. So how do one balance those two? And then also relating to that specific point, is in terms of where does he see the line between being offensive towards a culture, because you've got a different view about the culture, and being, you know, harmful in so that it actually translates to hate speech and pronouncing on that. So I would like to hear his view on that specific point. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honorable Smith. Mr. Parks, over to you.
Thanks to the Chair, and thanks to all of my members. I think the questions are really helpful and positive. So I think it indicates to me that we're all kind of recognizing this is a challenge that collectively we all are facing. We all have to try to address in a common sense way. We appreciate it's not an easy thing. It's not an easy thing to kind of guide what people say. We have to try to get the right balance. So, Chair, I think to Honorable, and I think even to Honorable Badenholt as well, and we think it's important to include culture in terms of harm, because it speaks to economic harm, social harm, psychological and so forth, and all of them have valid instances that you might have suffered as a society, as a community, as an individual. But we just felt that there is a need to include cultural harm. We appreciate that the bill can't be open-ended and cover a million things. But I think given the strong linkage between culture and identity, language group, racial group, the history of South Africa, there is a need to do so. South Africa deliberately for many, many decades instituted harm to communities based on a cultural preference. And sadly, that hasn't completely ended post-1994. Obviously not at the same level, obviously, but, you know, the instances, Chair, that you would find in the example I mentioned about Centurion, where Muslim families in Centurion were being harassed because the mosque was calling into prayer. So we think those are the kind of examples. Chair, I think also just thought about the Dover around would it pass constitutional muster? We think it would, definitely. We assume the Chief State Law Advisor has given a constitutional certificate beforehand, and the Parliamentary Legal Advisors likewise. But you have to look on the principal issues. The Constitution isn't a blank check. Yes, everyone has rights, but all rights come with responsibilities. So yes, you know, the right to freedom of speech, that's a very critical right. It shouldn't be tampered with lightly, but there's limitations. So for example, you can't go to a cinema, a crowded cinema, and shout fire, to use that common example, because there's a risk now to people stampede, people might die. And one could simply say, well, I just expressed my views, and it's not a crime to be an idiot. But in that instance, there could have been lethal consequences to it. So I think a police officer, a judge, in any instance, or the prosecutors, would have to weigh up, was it just simply a question of me being drunk at a braai and being obnoxious? Or what is the impact also to society? And I think that's also why in the sentencing provisions it says up to 8 years. So the law enforcement institutions would have to weigh up, what is the damage, what is the intent, what is the offense, and so forth. We appreciate it's not going to be an easy thing. It's not as clear-cut, for example, as assault or theft. But nonetheless, it is a significant thing. And I think also, Chair, if we don't deal with it in society, there can be a dangerous consequence, which can be much more harmful. If we allow a society where people insult each other on Facebook based upon racial groups, across political tendency, that can get out of control and it can create real issues. We're not that far away from it at times, sadly. I think we have seen instances during July 2021 in Durban at times. So we think the Constitutional Court would look at, is discrimination allowed? And they would say no. They would say, do you have a right to dignity? And the court would say, yes, you do. The Constitution also compels the state, the legislature, to use legislation, etc., to advance the cause of equity and equality, look at the issue of redress for historical issues. And of course, there are limits to all rights and responsibilities and other international legal precedents. Actually, I think it's just the sanctions and so forth. Look, you don't want to fill prisons with people. Ideally, we'd rather go the restorative route, warning, counselling, etc. But for those who really commit significant offences, you'd have to do something. You would have to make a few examples of a few people to punish them, to send a message to society. There are certain things which you can't tolerate in society, that they need to change. And one should not place the rights of an individual to be offensive upon the rights of society to dignity. We have to respect other people's rights. Even if we have different beliefs, we might have different religions, etc., we should be respectful to each other's religions. And there's enough space in a democracy for us to do so. We shouldn't be going the route where at times you'll find in some European countries where they want to interfere with how, for example, Muslim girls or women might need to dress, etc. All of the Dover is right. I mean, you don't want to have everybody going to prison, but obviously when the matter is serious enough, the intent is serious enough, they sure that must be the route. But ideally, we want to go the route of restorative justice where possible. We want to change culture. We want to make sure our educational institutions help guide society in the right direction. And of course, you know, as parents, we also have an obligation to raise our children correctly, to embrace each other. And in order to do it right, we have to address the socioeconomic divisions of society because the fact that you have a wealthy suburb like Constantia, overwhelmingly white, a poor colored working class community like Mannenberg, and a poor working class African community like Khayelitsha. And all the socioeconomic poverty, the unemployment, the gender-based violence, the crimes, etc., hit the poor proportionally harder, and obviously hit people who are African and colored working class women the hardest. So we have to address that, because these things will just address it on a superficial level. The fundamental issue is how to rebuild a non-racial society in our economy, etc. And that's, I think, sadly, it's going to take quite a long time. But we do think that the 8-year sentencing is appropriate because it goes up to 8 years. So obviously, the prosecutor, the magistrate, must choose what is appropriate, what is the level of offense, what is the intention, what is the impact, etc. We were concerned in the first draft of the bill that we felt the sentencing was a little bit too light when it then talked about, I think, 3 to 5 years. And we think we couldn't take hate crimes or hate speech lightly. If someone dies of the consequence, there was someone like in the case of Rwanda, the people on the radio stations, they didn't kill anybody themselves, perhaps, but they mobilized society through hate speech to go and kill 1 million people in 90 days. I think to Honorable Bottomlaw, in terms of the definition of hate, if I read it correctly, I think sections 3 and 4 speak to the definition of the offensive hate crime, the offensive hate speech. I think it does go into a fair bit of detail, and obviously I think it links to the issue of harm. So I would believe that those are sufficient, but if the members think that they need to strengthen it further, but we had felt that it was sufficient in terms of defining what is a hate crime and what is hate speech, and linking it to the definitions of discrimination and harm and so forth. To Honorable Smith, look, we do appreciate it's a difficult thing. It's not an easy thing. People have different religions, different values, etc. But we need to be sensitive to each other. We should be sensitive to, you know, people of different ethnic groups and religion. And I think there is a bit of a need for a legal framework to guide what is acceptable, what is not acceptable. If we just simply leave it as a blank slate and people can choose how they want to do it, then things get out of control. Then you will find people attacking people because they're Muslim, because they're Jewish, or whatever the instance might be. And that's going to cause problems, that's going to cause conflict. So I think it's about how to try to prevent it, as the title of the bill says, how to try to promote education, etc. But I think it shows, you know, the incident of the cow on the beach in Cape Town, the call to prayer in Centurion, etc., many other instances. I think we've seen the issue of the swimming pool incident in Bloemfontein, I think it was last year, January. all of this shows that we're sitting on a ticking time bomb, and there is a need to, for us to be much more comprehensive and give a very clear legal guidelines to the police, to prosecutors, to society. It's also difficult for the police. You would come to them as a parent if your child has been assaulted because of the color of the skin, and the police might say, well, is that a crime? Is freedom of speech a crime? Yes, he was offensive, he insulted you, but what's the crime? So here we're now going to assist the police to say, on this, these are the types of incidents which are a crime. This is how you define them, how you deal with them. Same thing with the National Prosecuting Authority, same thing with the judges. They can't just charge or prosecute or convict based upon feelings. They have to do so based upon law. And now we're going to have a law to say, here's how you manage these instances. But I think, of course, you know, the police, the NPA, the judges will always have to weigh up what is the intention. Was the person just being an idiot and drunk at a bribe? Do they intend to mobilize society? What is the harm to the person? You know, did they humiliate the cleaner at the University of the Free State? What are the consequences to society? Because obviously if you mobilize people to engage in violence, they must be hit with heavy consequences. I think for us, it provides the right balance, not an easy balance to do so, but we are confident this one does provide the right correct balance in a very sensitive, very complicated issue. And I think in the longer run, it'll help move us in the correct directions as a society. It might be a bit of a learning curve for the first year, 2 years, but I think in the end, we'll be better off for it. And we're not alone in the world going through this journey. I think many other countries have gone through similar journeys, and they've shown us correct that you need to deal with such issues and not take it too lightly as a consequence. Whether it's Rwanda or Israel, many other countries. So I think this is a positive step in the right direction. But, yeah. Hopefully I answered the questions and didn't justice the members' question. Thank you very much, Chair Members.
Thank you very much, Mr. Park, for your response to members' questions. We've come to the end of our session with you. Thank you. Members, we move then on to the next presentation by Gender Diversity Coalition. We have Max Belinda, who I'm told will be making the presentation. Mom, are you okay? So you are on the platform. Maybe can you confirm that you're on the platform?
Good afternoon. I am on the platform. Can you hear me?
Yes. Let me welcome you once again to this meeting. And also thank you for your submission that you've made on the hate crime hate speech law, as well as today making the presentation to the committee. We'll be giving you 15 minutes to make your presentation, and thereafter members will interact or ask you questions for clarity. And we prefer that you focus on what your issues are with the ball, as well as what your recommendations are. Over to you.
Thank you so much. Am I able to share my screen?
Gershwin, can you? Okay, yes. Yes, you can.
Can you see it?
No, not yet. Though we do have your written submission, if you wish to speak to it, it's open for answer.
Okay. So it seems like I'm struggling to share my presentation, so I'll just speak to the submission, and I'll take it from there.
Please, continue.
Good afternoon, Chair Members. I would like to greet you and also thank you for this opportunity to comment orally on the prevention and combating of hate crimes and hate speech bill. My name is Belinda Kwakamba. I am part of the National Gender Diversity Coalition, and today I'll be representing the voice of the National Coalition. My pronouns are they and them. So my presentation will give a brief background on the National Gender Diversity Coalition as a recognized body in South Africa, the positionality of the coalition with regards to the bill, also shed light on some empirical evidence that affect the realities of the community we are serving, and our concerns, and further a brief conclusion with regards to that. So established in 2019, the National Gender Diversity Coalition is a coalition of organizations working in trans, gender diverse, and intersex communities. It consists of 11 SOGIESC-specific organizations and 3 legal partners, making it a total of 14 civil society organizations that are positioned all across South Africa. The aim of the collective is really to provide strategic leadership and direction to ensure the advancement of legal and social recognition of trans and gender diverse persons in South Africa and beyond. The focus of the coalition is really much on bodily autonomy, self-actualization, self-determination for transgender persons, gender diverse persons, intersex persons, under the jurisdiction of the Republic of South Africa. So as the coalition, we really welcome the opportunity by the NCOP to orally comment on the bill. We deem hate crimes legislation as fundamental to protect trans, gender diverse, and intersex persons in South Africa. However, we also acknowledge here that the bill is the necessary foundation that is needed, but there must be also a multifaceted approach in tackling the roots of hate and ultimately transform society. So as trans and diverse persons and ultimately intersex persons in South Africa, we are faced with daily threats of transphobic, intersex phobic, and other hate crimes and hate speech that are really direct to the community and to its individuals. These crimes range from harmful hate speech and often escalate and have the potential to escalate to violent abuse, rape, assault, and murder. These are crimes that are really motivated to dehumanize and dehumanize and erase gender minority groups. The realities of transgender diverse and intersex persons in South Africa, like elsewhere in the world, is characterized by a phase of violence, discrimination, trans and intersex antagonism. We are constant victims of hate that manifests covertly and overtly through hate speech, with pejorative language that seeks to dehumanize, erase, and disparage our identities. This verbal dehumanization is further explored through violent crimes ranging from physical abuse, rape, assault, and murder. There is also empirical evidence that we've done from our that comes out of various organizations, and this empirical evidence shows the extent of this violence and how it manifests and how it's directed to our communities. The Batselobha Trans study on transgender women reveals that violence in 3 South African cities, Buffalo City, Cape Town, and Johannesburg. And it really shows the gross human rights violation on transgender women, especially transgender women who are on a street base and living as on survival sex work. The Trans Rural Narratives is another research study by Gender Dynamics and endorsed by various other organizations that shows corrective rape prevail, and this phenomenon really being duplicated into the lives of transgender persons, where curative rape is found happening to transgender and queer individuals in rural and semi-rural communities. And it also reveals how these cases are often goes undocumented. The ACT annual report, human rights report, reveals 58% of the reported cases were perpetuated by law and police of officials on vulnerable black, poor, street-based, gender-diverse persons. And then another study that we've done with the Lawyers for Human Rights called Breaking Borders and Binaries shows that the intersection of violence with regards to gendered and transgender persons who are asylum seekers and refugees, really showcasing the intersection of transphobia, intersex phobia, and xenophobia. So as the coalition, we fully support this bill. We further ask that this bill not be longer prolonged, and that it must really start to take effect so that these crimes can really be dealt with through legislation. We also note the dogmatic wave of the anti-gender movement that is coming from the global north and really spilling across South Africa. And these bills really threaten gender and sexual minorities in this country. We therefore call on the NCOP to really fasten the process in protecting transgender persons in South Africa, intersex persons in South Africa, and ultimately gender diverse persons in South Africa. Thank you so much, Chair. I'll give over to you.
Thank you very much, Max. Belinda, how did you say you pronounce your surname?
It's Fatamba.
Okay. No, thank you very much for your presentation. Members, do you have any questions for clarity? Honorable Dadohu?
Thank you very much, Honorable Chair. Firstly, let us welcome the presentation. I think the presenter was very much eloquent, very much clear, and her bottom line is quite understandable. Now, my question is that the presenter says they welcome the bill. It must be fast-tracked, it must be expedited. But there are two issues that I'm thinking of. Firstly, is that those who transgress, there is a maximum sentence of 8 years. What is the comment of the presenter on that? And secondly, as she says, as the presenter says, represent about 14 organizations. These organizations are national. Are they found in all the provinces in South Africa? And if there are those who want to reach out to you, how do you facilitate that particular process? Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Honorable Dodo. Over to you, Max Belinda.
I will answer the second question first, and then I'll come back to the first question. So the 14 organizations that forms part of the Gender Diversity Coalition, as I said, they are associated specific organizations, and they come from all across South Africa. In example, Triangle Project is based in Cape Town with Gender Dynamics. Trans Hope is based in Durban with Same Love Toti, also based in Durban, Utingo, also based in Durban. And we have the two Johannesburg-based organizations, Iranti, Matima, Be True to Me, Access Chapter 2. Trans Wellness is an organization that does rural work on the rural transgender persons. So there's really a widespread of associate organizations that are widespread in South Africa. And then we have legal partners that we work with that form part of the coalition. And those organizations are legal resource centers, Lawyers for Human Rights, and the Women's Legal Center. So these organizations then provide that technical support to the gender diversity coalition. So some of the organizations within the gender diversity coalition provide direct services to transgender persons. Some of them document human rights violations, and some of them really provide more system level change within South Africa. So they're all South African based organizations.
Okay, and the other question was with regard to the maximum sentence of 8 years.
So the other question was regard to the maximum sentence of being 8 years. As I've stated, that as the National Gender Diversity Coalition, we support the contents of the bill. We have read, we understood the bill, support the bill as it stands. And we are really asking for this process to be fast-tracked, not for important and nuances to be undermined, but to be fast-tracked because we understand as well that there's lives at stake, and we want it to be looked at from that vantage point. So we welcome the 8 years that is being set as a maximum prison stay and sentence.
Okay, thank you very much for responding to members' question, and let me also thank your organization for making it into this bowl. We've come to the end of our session with you. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Our members, to move to the next presenter, I think members will note that there was a slight error in terms of the times on the schedule, the notice that was sent out to you. Our next presenter would be Media Monitoring Africa, Mr. William Bird. I'm not sure if Mr. Bird is on the platform, Gershwin. I need your guidance here.
Hello, ma'am, may I speak? It's William Bird.
Oh, Mr. Bird. Okay. Let me welcome you to.
I'm here, but just to interrupt. I'm still waiting for our actual speaker. To join us. He'll be with us any moment. So while I and my colleague are here, we're not ready to present. He'll hopefully be with us in the next three minutes or so.
No, it's quite understandable. My apologies. I think we communicated a time to you. We kind of made a mistake with the time on the schedule. My apologies. But it's understandable. And if it would be okay, honourable members, I want to just verify whether the Association of Christian Media is on the platform, Mr. Philip Rosenthal. Are you on the platform? Mr. Rosenthal. Okay. Okay. All right. And then is Vika Labantu on the platform? No. Okay, members, can I propose to take a 10-minute break? It's 3:20 according to the clock in front of me.
Sorry, I'll interrupt again. It's William Bird. I see the advocate Benwick has joined us. So if you would like, we can, or you can take your 10-minute pause, or I believe that we should be ready. I'll just check with him. I see he's in the meeting now. He's there.
Yeah, let us take the 10-minute pause. You can grab something to drink, stretch your legs. If someone said yesterday, you can also go for a smoke break if you wish. Yes, 10 minutes at 3:30, we'll then continue.
Recording stopped.